Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning and welcome to Essex Church, where this community of Kensington Unitarians meets each Sunday, as well as for other activities during the week. This is a community created by all those who walk through our doors, doors that have been open now for 34 years, as yesterday, I think, was the 34th anniversary of the opening of this particular building. So whether you're someone who knew the previous Essex Church on this site, or someone for whom this feels quite a new place to be, you're warmly welcomed here today. As Unitarians, we pride ourselves on being a creedless church. Nobody here will tell us what to believe. But that absence of fixed beliefs gives us the responsibility, again and again and again, to examine our faith and to ensure that how we live our lives is in accord with that which we hold dear. So these opening words written by Maureen Killeran remind us of that commitment to faith in action. In this free church, we come together without creed, focusing instead on the core values of justice, equity, compassion, of mutual acceptance of diverse ways of being, as we seek to connect ourselves more fully with the unfolding truths of life and of our world. We come together in shared conviction that all people deserve a voice in matters that concern them, and that it is up to each of us to protect the rights of all, particularly those who, for whatever reason, have long been held in silence. We come together in the stubborn belief that community is possible and that peace is more than a dream. We commit together to affirm our actions, in our actions as well as our words, the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. In this free church, we come together without creed, believing that the way we live in the world bears testament to the value of our beliefs. And when we light this chalice each week, it's oft times as a celebration of freedom. Today, may its flame remind us that such liberty also carries responsibility. Responsibility for the oppressed and for all those who cannot speak out for themselves. In this spirit of truth and justice and liberty, we can kindle our chalice flame this day. You perhaps have noticed, if you've looked at the order of service sheet, that today's service has Charles Dickens and his social message as a theme. To take on the character of Ebenezer Scrooge was way beyond my limited skills, so Anthony has offered to take on the character.
This reading comes from Charles Dickens' famous work, A Christmas Carol. In this conversation, one of Ebenezer Scrooge's business associates asks Scrooge to contribute to a charity to help the poor. "Well, many thousands are in want of common comfort, sir." "Are there prisons?" asked Scrooge. "There are plenty of prisons," said the gentleman, laying down the pen again. "And the union workhouses?" demanded Scrooge. "Are they still in operation?" "They are still," returned the gentleman. "I wish I could say they are not." "The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigour then," said Scrooge.
Both very busy, sir."
"I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course," said Scrooge. "I'm very glad to hear it."
"Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christmas cheer of mind or body to the multitude," returned the gentleman, "a few of us are endeavouring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and a means of warmth. What shall I put you down for?"
"Nothing," Scrooge replied.
"You wish to be anonymous?"
"I wish to be left alone," said Scrooge.
Since you ask me what I wish, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there. Many can't go there, and many would rather die. If they had rather die, said Scrooge, they had better do it, and decrease the surplus population.
Fabulous. It's a service of extra readings today. And I don't know, I mean, I could tell you the plot of most of Dickens's novels, I think. I've never read one. I don't know if anybody else is in that same condition. They're actually not very easy to read. And since I've gathered most of my information, therefore, from films, cartoons and the like, perhaps it's not surprising that I miss out whole bits of the actual plot. So the reading that we're going to hear now is from my friend and colleague, Reverend Margaret Kirk, who does read a book properly. And in it, she writes about returning to read A Christmas Carol again for the first time since childhood. And she is really struck by the ghost of Christmas past and what he takes Scrooge back to. Because, of course, I have Scrooge as the baddie, the meanie, but in fact, the ghost of Christmas past takes Scrooge back to his own past, where he sees himself alone when others are enjoying Christmas with his family. He sees himself left at school alone when all the other children are going off back to their families. And Dickens describes how at one of these, a lonely boy was reading near a feeble fire, and Scrooge sat down upon a form and wept to see his poor forgotten self as he had used to be. Not a sigh among the leafless boughs of one despondent poplar, but fell upon the heart of Scrooge with a softening influence and gave a freer passage to his tears. And again, the ghost of Christmas past takes Scrooge back to see what a lonely, unhappy child he was. And then my friend Margaret says, the story of the transformation of Ebenezer Scrooge from miser to generous giver is one that's designed to prick our conscience, to make us reflect on our own behaviour, make us ashamed of those times when we too have been mean-spirited. But far more powerful for me, she says, as I read this story, is the picture of the lonely boy and the tears that the adult Scrooge sheds for that lonely, despairing child. Far more powerful for me are the humble origins of the adult Scrooge's tight-fisted holding and grasping, born out of a sea of loneliness, in the heart of a child who is frightened and helpless, desperate to make connections and to find consolation. Far, far more powerful for me is Dickens' awareness that when the ghost of Christmas past taps the most painful memories of all, Scrooge's tears begin to flow for that frightened child. And then, and only then, suffering is made conscious and real healing can begin. Let's take that thought now into a time of prayer and reflection. As I call on the Divine Spirit of life and love to be with us now, and to bless all that we say and do together here today. And I invite you now to think of just how much we do care. We care about one another and the kind of world we live in. And how sometimes the care that we feel scares us. At times we're afraid to care too much. Too much for those who we love. Too much for friends and companions along the way. Too much for all the pain and poverty and injustice in the world. Too much for those who suffer needlessly and without cause. Too much for the passing of transient beauty in life before our eyes. Too much for the depth of anguish and grief we might feel if we allowed ourselves to care too much for what can so easily be lost. Give us strength to join in both body and spirit with the hopes and the aspirations of people everywhere. Let our loving concern for those in our midst be the spark that strengthens our loving concern for universal humanity. Let our care and our actions be our prayer in the daily human expression of our loving concern. Help us, O God, to dare to care, now and here and everywhere. Amen. So a short reading now from Claire Tomalin's latest biography on Charles Dickens. She speaks of the complexity of Dickens's character and of his life, and says that he the whole world knows Dickens, his London and his characters. All his characters are my personal friend, said Tolstoy, who kept his portrait hanging in his study, declared him to be the greatest novelist of the 19th century. He left a trail like a meteor, and everyone finds their own version of Charles Dickens. The child victim, the irrepressibly ambitious young man, the reporter, the demonic worker, the tireless walker, the radical, the protector of orphans, helper of the needy, man of good works, republican, the hater and lover of America, the giver of parties, the magician, the traveller, the satirist, the surrealist, the mesmerist, the angry son, the good friend, the bad husband, the quarreller, the sentimentalist, the secret lover, the despairing father, the francophile, the player of games, a lover of circuses, the maker of punch, the country squire, the editor, the smoker, the drinker, the dancer of reels and hornpipes, the actor, the ham. Too mixed to be a gentleman, but wonderful. The irrepressible and unrepeatable Boz. The brilliance in the room, the inimitable. And above and beyond every other description, simply the great, hard-working writer who noticed and celebrated the small people living on the margins of society and who set 19th century London before our eyes. Words from Claire Tomlin. And as he didn't do so badly as Ebenezer Scrooge, I'm bringing him on now as George Orwell, who wrote a fabulous essay.
Unfortunately, I can't do George Orwell's voice, but it did occur to me that Orwell lived around the corner. Back of Notting Hill, there's a blue plaque house around it. This makes it a bit more, like, immediate. So, with that in mind, just some extracts from his excellent essay on Dickens, which is available online. It seems that in every attack Dickens makes upon society, he's always pointing to a change of spirit rather than a change in structure. It's hopeless to try and pin him down to any definite remedy, still more to any political doctrine. His approach is always along the moral plane, useless to change institutions without a change of the human heart. That, essentially, is what he's always saying. If that were all, he might be no more than a cheer-up writer, a reactionary humbug. A change of heart is, in fact, the alibi of people who do not wish to endanger the status quo. But Dickens is not a humbug, except in minor matters. And the strongest single impression one carries away from his books is that of a hatred of tyranny. The thing that drove Dickens forward into a form of art for which he was not really suited, and at the same time caused us to remember him, was simply the fact that he was a moralist, the consciousness of having something to say. He's always preaching a sermon, and that is the final secret of his inventiveness. For you can only create if you care. Types like Squeers and Micawber could not have been produced by a hack writer looking for something to be funny about. A joke worth laughing at always has an idea behind it, and it's usually a subversive idea. Dickens is able to go on being funny because he's in revolt against authority, and authority is always there to be laughed at. There's always room for one more custard pie. His radicalism is of the vaguest kind, and yet one always knows that it's there. That's the difference between being a moralist and a politician. He has no constructive suggestions, not even a clear grasp of the nature of the society he's attacking, only an emotional perception that something is wrong. All he can finally say is, behave decently. Which, as I suggested earlier, is not necessarily so shallow as it sounds. Most revolutionaries are potential Tories because they imagine that everything can be put right by altering the shape of society. Once that change is effective, as it sometimes is, they see no need for any other. Dickens has not this kind of mental coarseness. The vagueness of his discontent is the mark of its permanence. What he's out against is not this or that institution, but, as Chesterton put it, an expression on the human face. Roughly speaking, his morality is the Christian morality. But in spite of his Anglican upbringing, he was essentially a Bible Christian, as he took care to make plain when writing his will. In any case, he cannot properly be described as a religious man. He believed, undoubtedly, but religion in the devotional sense does not seem to have entered much into his thoughts. Where he is Christian is in his quasi-instinctive siding with the oppressed against the oppressors. As a matter of course, he is on the side of the underdog, always and everywhere.
We heard an extract earlier on from George Orwell's famous essay on Dickens, and he begins that essay by commenting that Dickens has often been stolen, as it were, by various causes who claim him for their own. Orwell remarks on the fact that Dickens's body itself was in some way stolen by the powers that be, because Dickens had been asked to be buried in the Kent countryside that he loved so well. Then the Dean of Rochester Cathedral thought it more appropriate that he'd be buried in the cathedral itself. And then an article written in the Times newspaper campaigned for Dickens to be buried in Westminster Abbey, and indeed he was. Now, we Unitarians often claim Dickens as our own, and as the quote from one of his letters on the front of today's Order of Service shows, he himself considered himself a Unitarian for a while before a more liberal form of Anglicanism called to him. Indeed, he attended services at Essex Street Chapel for a while when it was on a previous site, but it is where our congregation has its roots. But he actually became known as a pew holder at Little Portland Street Chapel here in London. And what drew Dickens to Unitarianism after a promotional tour in the United States, where he met various influential Unitarians, was its message of the potential for social reform, the possibility of making things better for ordinary people, and its message of the need, the desperate need for such reform. Dickens was always a really keen observer of people and the lives they were leading, and life for many in Victorian times, as we well know, was incredibly harsh. I read a children's introduction to Dickens' life and work this week, written by Andrea Warren, which mentioned that the average lifespan for a poor person living in 19th century London was 22 years. It was actually 28 years for people of all social classes. The speed of industrialisation had attracted literally millions of people from the country to the metropolis in search of work. London could not cope. Child mortality was shockingly high, and children from poor families who survived had to struggle every day for those very basic necessities. Dirty water sources brought epidemics of diseases such as cholera, and sewage was poured, literally poured, into the streets and the rivers. Dickens was such a powerful describer of these dreadful conditions. It's no surprise then, is it really, that the term Dickensian now immediately evokes images of poverty and despair. Poor children in urban settings rarely received any education in early Victorian times. But perhaps in that they were in some ways fortunate, for another of Dickens's targets was, of course, education itself, which too often was harsh and boring and pointless, learning by rote with frequent use of physical punishment, and with an acceptance and even an encouragement of bullying and cruelty amongst children themselves. Many of Dickens's novels feature dreadful schools and villainous schoolmasters in which children were forced to endure their fate, with no voice to cry out at the injustices, both physical and mental, that they were experiencing. Dickens was called on by his friend, the heiress Angela Coutts, to advise her in the establishment of ragged schools in London for poor children, and that is a very interesting history in itself. And Dickens and Coutts also worked to establish a home in Shepherd's Bush for women in danger of becoming prostitutes or who were already working in that trade. So education was one of Dickens's targets, and another, as we know well, was the English legal system that followed arcane and incomprehensible paths, too often leading to injustice rather than justice. And often, again, Dickens focused particularly on the effect that this system had on children. For instance, one of the things that Orwell mentions, that in Dickens's youth, children were still being solemnly tried at a criminal bar where they were held up to be seen by the public and the jury. It was not so long since boys of 13 had been hanged for petty theft. And of course, the whole issue of cruelty in child rearing was a very serious issue at this time. There was a famous book, a standard children's book at that time, called The Fairchild Family. And it gives you some idea of the length to which child discipline was sometimes carried. For Mr. Fairchild, when he caught his children quarrelling, he would thrash them, and then he would take them to spend the afternoons beneath a gibbet where the rotting corpse of a murderer is hanging. Dickens also focused on the fact that scores of thousands of children were working, sometimes as early as the age of six, literally being worked to death, sweeping chimneys in mines or cotton mills, and the cruelty of the school system that I've always already mentioned. And of course, Dickens was writing at times about his own experiences. His own father was incarcerated for a while in a debtor's prison, along, as was often the case, with his whole family. Dickens was eventually sent to an uncle and then out to work at the age of 12 in a London blacking factory. For him, this was a very shaming experience, and it's credited with helping him to awaken to the sufferings that others were experiencing. I mean, as Claire Tomlin points out in her recently published biography, Dickens was a very complex and a contradictory character, a bit like all of us, perhaps. He lived, though, in a fascinating time, a time of great social change, and he lived a fascinating life. In this 200th anniversary of his birth, I suspect there are going to be many explorations of these contradictions in his character. For example, his passionate support for fallen women, as women involved in prostitution or who gave birth to a child whilst not married were called. His great level of care for such women seems to have been in stark contrast to his relationship with his wife, Catherine, from whom he eventually separated. But despite all, perhaps because of these contradictions, Dickens became, in his own lifetime, a national institution. I think partly because of his remarkably effective self-publicity and his incredible commitment to hard work. And of course, from his position as England's best-loved writer, he was able to criticise the government and national institutions such as the education and legal systems. He was actually able to make a difference in ordinary people's lives. Rather like a 21st century celebrity, Dickens lived very much in the public eye, with details of his marital troubles written about in the press. And he left many of his letters for us to read after his death. They're published in 12 volumes, in case you're interested to know more. But when I consider his work and his life, what strikes me more than anything else is his ability to give a voice to otherwise silent people. Small children, those living in shame, people who have nothing. He gave the poor and the suffering a voice that was heard by the government and by those working in education and law. It was a voice that was heard by Queen Victoria and by the aristocrats of her day. And when I think of life in 21st century Britain, it seems to me that there are still plenty of those hidden people whose voices need to be heard. There are still plenty of wrongs that need to be righted. There are injustices being perpetrated at this very time in the name of budgetary constraint and fiscal requirements. I wonder what Charles Dickens would make of it all. Amen.